What up, y'all? You're listening to Sports Talk with Trop, and I'm your host, Katie Trop. On today's bonus episode, I've compiled some past lists of mine from previous episodes. Decided since it's the NBA playoffs, might as well do some NBA-related lists. So we've got the Trop 5 greatest NBA comebacks, the Trop 5 multi-time MVPs, and the Trop 5 conference finals performances. Team. All right, and then with Luka Doncic having that fucking fantastic, record-breaking, historic night in the NBA earlier this week, it got me to thinking about some of the greatest NBA comebacks. I did mention that Tracy McGrady comeback years ago, and it actually does make this list. I decided to do the Trop 5 greatest NBA comebacks. And, of course, T-Mac does make this one because it was an excellent comeback. And so I have the actual statistics rather than just me bouncing off my memory. So let's get it started with the Trop 5 greatest NBA comebacks. Most of these are actually regular season. And I think that's just because, a series is more about the entire thing, whereas, like, one comeback in one game is usually just, like, one game. So the majority of these are actually regular season games, but there is one awesome fucking playoff game in here as well. So let's get it started with number five on my Trop 5 greatest NBA comebacks. With number five, December 9th, 2004, the San Antonio Spurs versus the Houston Rockets. Yes, this is the T-Mac game I was referencing in the last episode. This was a crazy ending sequence. I mean, the Houston Rockets were down 76-68 with 36 seconds left to go and no timeouts. Now, T-Mac, Tracy McGrady is probably one of the most underrated players of all time. He doesn't get talked about like a lot of the legends do, but if you watched Tracy McGrady in real time, this dude was so much fun to watch. He could score so quick and so fast, and he could do it by himself. And he was just such a fun-ass player to watch. And this was probably his greatest moment. Well, one of his greatest moments. And he did this a few times, but this was one of the greatest times that he did it. So there were 36 seconds left to go. And basically what would happen is in a sequence of 33 seconds, Tracy McGrady would go off and score 13 points. He would score 4 3-pointers. One of them he would actually get fouled on, so it would be a 4-point play. And it's just one of the craziest sequence of events because, you know, so they've got the ball at 36 seconds. They pass the ball real quick to McGrady. He tosses up for a three, knocks it down. Then the Spurs get the ball back, of course. They foul the Spurs real quick, and they actually knock down one of the two free throws. So it's not like the Spurs aren't even scoring points in between on this little sequence here. They do, but there's also some big defensive stops that the Rockets would end up getting in just this matter of 36 seconds. And they would go back and forth. And ultimately, the Houston Rockets would get the win 81-80. It was just one of the craziest sequence of events to ever watch because usually when you're down with just 36 seconds left to go, you're thinking, yeah, there's this outside shot that something could happen. But chances are, and you got to remember at this time, this is at the height of the San Antonio Spurs dynasty. We're talking Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, Manu Ginobili. You know, we're talking these type of dudes on the team. And then at this time also, the Houston Rockets were a damn good team with that. You know, Tracy McGrady, this was Yao Ming as well. So this was a heated rivalry. And for T-Mac to do this, it was insane. And it was just an insane to come back to watch. And it really does sear in my brain. Like, I think about this moment all the time, just at how insane it was for T-Mac to do that. And as I said, I've always kind of felt like T-Mac is one of the most underrated players in NBA history just because he does not get the same type of accolades. And obviously, it's because, you know, he never competed for a championship. None of the teams he ever was on actually ever made it really far into the playoffs. So I kind of feel like, you know, he doesn't have much of a postseason history for us to be like, oh yeah, remember when T-Mac did that? But nah, man, T-Mac was just a fun ass player to watch. And I just miss that dude because he was just, I loved Tracy McGrady no matter what uniform that dude was in. Then at number four in my Trop 5 greatest NBA comebacks It was May 7th, 1995. Now, this is the only one where we had a playoff game. It was game one of the Eastern Conference semifinals between the Indiana Pacers and the New York Knicks. If you are a basketball fan, you know what this game is. This is called the Reggie Miller game, where he would go off for 8 points in 9 seconds. Yeah, 9 freaking seconds. And this was a heated rivalry at the time. You know, this is a playoff game. Both these teams damn good. You know, this is a Patrick Ewing-led New York Knicks team. And then, of course, the great Reggie Miller on the Indiana Pacers. So the Pacers are down 105-99 with 18 seconds left to go. And in a matter of 9 seconds, Reggie Miller would make some huge fucking plays. He would first get the ball, make a three-pointer. And then as the Knicks are trying to inbound the ball, he gets the huge defensive play, knocks down another three-pointer. And it's just one of the craziest plays you'll ever see. It's actually a very infamous play, if you know what I'm talking about, when Reggie Miller turns to one of the biggest Knicks fans, Spike Lee, in the crowd and gives him the, like, choking sign where he's, like, strangling himself, basically, like, ha-ha, you bitch-ass Knicks choked. Because that's what would happen in this game, is the Indiana Pacers would go on to not only win this game, but they won the series as well, but they won game one of the Eastern Conference semis, 107-105. In one of the most crazy historic games of all time. But to see Reggie Miller just get 8 points in 9 seconds, it's nuts. Because he just, like, literally just turned around, like, boom, 3 points. Boom, defensive play. Boom, 3 points. Ah, bitch, we win. Like, it was just crazy to watch, and just an excellent, excellent comeback in NBA history. Then at number three on my top five greatest NBA comebacks, it is April 30th, 2021, so actually not that long ago. It is the Boston Celtics versus the San Antonio Spurs. This was actually kind of similar to what happened with Luka the other night when he was playing for the Mavericks, because in this one, you know, Luka had a historic triple-double and he dropped 60 points, so you got to talk about that. But in this one, a motherfucker dropped 60 points. And that dude is Jason motherfucking Tatum. He dropped 60 points in this game. And he would be the huge reason why the Boston Celtics were able to make a huge comeback against the San Antonio Spurs. At one point in this game, Boston was down 32 points in the second quarter. They were able to cut the lead down to 13 in the third quarter. And they were able to end up forcing overtime, in which Jason Tatum, he just took over this game in the second half. And they were able to force overtime and eventually get the win, 143-140. So that was just a crazy turn of events. As I said, being down 32, I mean, I think that's it's legitimately one of the ranked highest. I think it's one of the top five biggest comebacks points-wise ever, and it just happened a few years ago. And when somebody drops 60 points like Jason Tatum, that just goes to show how much he meant to this team, how much he drove this team to win that game, just like Luka did earlier in the week for the Dallas Mavericks. Then at number two on my top five greatest NBA comebacks, you know I got to get my boy Kobe Bryant in on this shit, because Kobe was the king of the comeback. And there are actually many points in his career that you could talk about comebacks. I mean, obviously, the 81-point game is one of the most phenomenal, because the Lakers did have to make a comeback in that game. That's what a lot of people don't usually discuss, is that the Lakers were getting their ass beat in that game, and so Kobe had to go off, and he ended up scoring 81. But that's not this game. This is actually much earlier than that. It would be in December 6th. 2002, the Dallas Mavericks versus the Los Angeles Lakers. This is a damn good Mavericks team, by the way. This is the Steve Nash, Dirk Nowitzki era, okay? So this is a really good Mavericks team. And but this is also a really good Lakers team. This is right at their height of their three-win dynasty right there. So at one point in this game, they were down 30 points in the third quarter. Then they were still down 27 points in the fourth quarter. So it's like, how the fuck is this going to happen? Well, Kobe Bryant would be that dude. He would go off. This is kind of like a signature game for him, where he would really, like, take over And while at the time he hadn't coined this term yet, but this was definite Mamba mentality right here. Bryant would end up with 21 points, and he would also have the game-winning basket with 8.4 seconds left to go in a game when the Lakers would end up winning 105-103. And like I said, they were down 30 points at one time. So this is another one of those games where it's one of the biggest deficits in history where they were able to come back. And this was, like I said, a damn good Mavericks team, damn good Lakers team, and it was a damn good comeback. And you know I had to put my homeboy Kobe Bryant in there because I always got to put Kobe Bryant in my my basketball lists because I love Kobe. And then at number one on my top five greatest NBA comebacks, it's literally the biggest comeback in NBA history. It was on November 27th, 1996. The Utah Jazz versus the Denver Nuggets. Yes, this Utah Jazz team was when the Utah Jazz were one of the best teams in the league. This was with Karl Malone and John Stockton and Jeff Hornacek. At one point, they were down 70-36 at halftime. They would be down 36 points at one point in this game. And in the second half, they would mount one of the greatest comebacks in NBA history ever. Karl Malone would end up with 31 total points. Jeff Hornacek would end up with 29 points. And the Utah Jazz would end up getting the win 107-103 after being down 70-36 at halftime. So yeah, that had to be number one. You know, I wanted to put Kobe at number one, but when you're down 36 points and in your own home too, this was in Utah. And at the time, Utah was one of the craziest places to play because it's really, the crowd gets really loud. They still are really loud, but since they're not as good of a team, they're not as loud. But this Utah Jazz team was one of the best of all time. And they were able to come back from 36 points down and come back, have the greatest, one of the greatest NBA comebacks in NBA history still to this day. So yeah, that's the top five greatest NBA comebacks. So let's go ahead and get to this week's top five list. And since I mentioned Nikola Jokic is in very rare class by winning his third MVP in his career, I decided this week's top five is going to be the top five multi-game NBA MVP award winners. Just because, I mean, yeah, these are obviously excellent basketball players. And to win the award once is a big deal, but to win it three or more times, it really just shows what a dominating figure you were, especially in your era. So I decided, let's go ahead and rank the top five of them out of the nine. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Jokic did not make the list. For one, the reason why he didn't make the list is because his career is not over yet, so there's potential he could actually win more MVP awards, which would just elevate him above maybe a couple of these guys. But also at the same time, I don't think Jokic's dominance is as dominating as the five above him. Now, of course, winning three MVPs is an amazing feat. But when ranking against all these other guys in the same class, I just kind of feel like he's not at least in the top five. I don't know where he would rank amongst all of them. I just ranked the five. But and also since I've already discussed, yeah, I think all five of these guys. Yeah, I in all five of these guys, I'm pretty sure actually. I think all five of them are actually ranked in my top 10 NBA GOATs list. So I've already rattled off on the majority of their career. So I'm mostly going to be focusing on their MVP seasons and just their overall dominance of the NBA at the time. So let's get it started off. And there wasn't really a better way to title this top five. So it's the top five multi-time NBA MVP award winners. I'm probably just going to say top five NBA MVPs just to, because that rolls off the tongue better. But all of these guys have won at least three or more MVPs. So let's begin with number five on my top five NBA MVPs, Wilt Chamberlain. This guy's dominance was absolutely insane. So Wilt Chamberlain, he is a four-time MVP. He won when he played with the Golden State Warriors in 1959, 1960. And then he played with he won his last three when he played with the 76ers in 65-66 season, 66-67 season, and the 67-68 season. So he won three straight MVPs. His first MVP that he won was actually his rookie season. He also won Rookie of the Year that year. And then just in Wilt Chamberlain's overall career, he is a two-time NBA champion. In those four MVP years, he did win a championship when he was with the 76ers in the 66-67 season, which was one of his most dominating seasons by far. But statistically, it's kind of insane to really just look at Wilt Chamberlain's statistics. If you just look at his numbers, it's absolutely insane. It's actually shitty that we don't have really a lot of footage from the majority of his career. I mean, we don't even have footage of the game where he scored 100 points. Like, the only time in the NBA somebody has scored 100 points, we don't have it on film. How shitty is that? None of us can ever rewatch that. Only the people who were there that day got to witness that shit. So a lot of Wilt Chamberlain's career, we don't even know how fucking good the dude was. But if you just look at his stats, boom, they blow you out of the water. So in his rookie year, the 1959-60 season, when he won his first MVP, he averaged 37.6 points per game and 27 rebounds per game. He averaged a double-double. Not only did he average a double-double a game that year, but like almost 40 points and almost 30 rebounds is what this dude averaged. And then just 2.3 assists per game is what he averaged there. Then his second MVP run when he was with the 76ers in the 65-66 season, he averaged 33.5 points per game, 24.6 rebounds per game, and 5.2 assists per game. So he did up his assist level a bit there, but still just averaging a double-double a game. Then his third MVP season when he won the championship with the 76ers, 66-67 season, he averaged 24.1 points per game, 24.2 rebounds per game, and 7 assists per game. So he was almost averaging a triple-double a game in that season. And then his final MVP year was in the 67-68 season where he averaged 24.3 points per game, 23.8 rebounds per game, and 8.6 assists per game. And Wilt Chamberlain, really, just his sheer dominance, he was the original, like, showboater. He was basically the beginning of just having amazing dunks and really just taking over the game. He was probably the first legitimate NBA superstar, really, because, you know, Bill Russell was a great player. But I wouldn't refer to Bill Russell as a superstar. He was just a straight-up motherfucking winner and a GOAT as well. But Wilt Chamberlain was a superstar. Wilt Chamberlain just took over games. He was all over the place, and he was just a phenomenal player and a four-time MVP and a two-time NBA champion and ranked number 5 on my multi-time NBA MVP award winners. Then at number 4 on my top 5 NBA MVPs, Larry Bird. He won 3 straight MVPs in 83, 84, 84, 85, 85, 86. Of course, those were all with the Boston Celtics. He is a 3-time NBA champion as well. In those MVP years, like I said, he won 3 league MVPs. 2 of those 3, he won a championship, the 83-84 season and the 85-86 season. Now, Larry Bird, it was actually really difficult for me to put him on this list because guess what? Magic Johnson is not on the list. I did not put Magic Johnson on the list. Now, Magic Johnson was a phenomenal player, one of the greatest of all time. As a matter of fact, on my top 10 GOATs, I do put Magic Johnson above him, but this is just ranking their MVP seasons. To me, Magic Johnson had, not that Larry Bird didn't have a great team surrounding him, he did, but Larry Bird was the dude on the Celtics. When it came to the Lakers, yes, Magic was the dude, but they also had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, literally one of the greatest players of all time. I mean, you have two of the greatest top 10 players on the same exact team. So that kind of takes away from Magic. Then all the other surrounding players, because that Lakers Showtime team was much more than just Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Like I said, the Celtics of the 80s also had a stacked-ass team, but Larry Bird was that dude, which is why I put him above Magic Johnson when it comes to their MVP seasons, just because Larry Bird was the dude on his team. So in his first MVP season, the 83-84 season, he averaged 24.2 points per game, 10.1 rebounds per game, and 6.6 assists per game. Then in his second MVP run in the 84-85 season, he averaged 28.7 points per game, 10.5 rebounds per game, and 6.6 assists per game. And then in his third MVP run in the 85-86 season, 25.8 points per game, 9.8 rebounds per game, and 6.8 assists per game. So for the most part, in both of the two of the three of those MVP runs, he averaged a double-double all season long, almost in the third one. But I mean, really, just Larry Bird's dominance at the time. He knew how to just absolutely take over a game. They were always in contention for the championship, and he was their dude. He was the star of that team. And that's why I do put Larry Bird's MVP seasons above Magic Johnson's MVP seasons, simply because Magic Johnson was also playing with arguably one of the greatest basketball players of all time, with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Then at number three on my top 10 NBA MVPs, Bill Russell. He is an 11-time NBA champion and a 4-time MVP. He won the MVP, all four of them, of course, with the Boston Celtics, since he spent his entire career with the Boston Celtics. He won his first MVP in the 1957-1958 season, second one in 1960-1961 season, third in 1961-1962 season, and his fourth and final one in the 62-63 season. So he did win three straight as well. That seems to be a pretty big theme here. Wilt Chamberlain won three straight. Larry Bird won three straight. Now we've got Bill Russell, who also won three straight. Out of his four MVPs, three of the four, he did win championships. He won championships in the 60-61, 61-62, and the 62-63 seasons. In the his first MVP run, the 57-58 season, he averaged 16.6 points per game, 22.7 rebounds per game, and 2.9 assists per game. Then his second MVP run in the 60-61 season, he averaged 16.9 points per game, 23.9 rebounds per game, and 3.4 assists per game. His third MVP run in the 61-62 season, he averaged 18.9 points per game, 23.6 rebounds per game, and 4.5 assists per game. And then in his final and fourth MVP run in the 62-63 season, he averaged 16.88 points per game, 23.6 rebounds per game, and 4.5 assists per game. So his entire career, especially in those four MVP seasons, he averaged a double-double every year. Bill Russell's another one of those guys where, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of film on him, but the film I have seen, it's amazing to watch him he literally would glide through the air. Watching Bill Russell, if you get a chance to watch some highlights of Bill Russell, you really should do it, just because he just would glide through the air. That's the only way to describe it, is him gliding through the air. He made it look like it was so easy to be a basketball player. And, an 11-time champion, he pretty much won every single year of his career. The absolute dominance, and he was the most dominating figure for his entire career. So to dominate the league the way he did, and to me, I can never, ever disrespect the career of Bill Russell. I think a lot of people still do. Out of all the players in the NBA, to me, Bill Russell has always been the most disrespected, not just career-wise, but like on a personal level, because, you know, he grew up, he came up in a very racist era of America, and he was not liked at all, even when he was winning championships. And you know, because in this day, if you are a fan of your team, there's no way you're going to criticize somebody of Bill Russell's stature. You're going to respect the shit out of him. And like I said, we don't see a lot of his career stats because, you know, I mean, he played in the freaking 60s, for Christ's sake. So, of course, that's a long ass time ago. And so that's tons and tons of players from the 60s all the way up to 2024, you know, that we've had, and we've got a lot of film on them. So it's really difficult for people to really grasp the dominance of Bill Russell and how amazing he was. But for me, I never, ever, ever disrespect the career of Bill Russell, because he is one of the most dominating figures to ever play this sport. And I've just always been amazed at the disrespect. I mean, I always reiterate the story about how he just got a statue in front of the Boston Celtics stadium, like in 2013, I believe it was. That's blasphemous, because, you know, I just was at the Lakers stadium, and not only did we have one Kobe statue, we're getting two more Kobe statues, and they didn't just have them. They had Kareem, they had Magic, they even had Wayne Gretzky, because, you know, that's where the Kings play. So there's like, it felt like 25 statues out there. Now there's probably only, I think, like five, but the Lakers, you know, they enshrine all their players, and every team always really does it up for their players. And to me, it's like Bill Russell always had this kind of rift with the Celtics, and I've always found just been dumbfounded by it, because I'm just like, he's literally one of the greatest players of all time and can't even get respect, not only as a human, but you won't even respect him as a player, an 11-time champion with four NBA MVPs. But I respect the shit out of Bill Russell. I will always sing the praises of Bill Russell. And like I always say, if you have not watched any Bill Russell highlights, they are on YouTube. Google Bill Russell highlights, and it's just amazing to watch him just glide through the air with the greatest of ease, like he was a trapeze artist. It's such a beautiful game that Bill Russell played. All right, and then at number two on my top five NBA MVPs, Michael Jordan. 6-time champion, of course, and he is a 5-time MVP. As a matter of fact, out of the 6 championships and the 5 MVPs, 4 of those MVPs were won during championship years, because it kind of feels like that's all Michael Jordan did. But I mean, the level of dominance with scoring with Michael Jordan is insane. Even compared to Wilt Chamberlain, the dude who scored 100 points in a game, when I compared Michael Jordan's stats from his MVP years compared to Wilt Chamberlain, even Michael Jordan outscored him in points per game in some of these years. So it's insane to look at how much Michael Jordan scored during his era. So he won his first MVP in the 1987-88 season, won his second one in the 1990-91 season, won his third one in the 91-92 season, won his fourth one when he came back from retirement, his first retirement in 95-96, and then he won his last MVP in the 97-98 season. Of course, Michael Jordan is arguably one of the greatest basketball players of all time. So he, of course, has to be one of the top 5, absolutely number 1 or 2 to me personally, just because his dominance. Now, I grew up in the Michael Jordan era. Michael Jordan he played with great teams, great players, but Michael Jordan dominated the league. He changed everything for all. Any entertainment person in this day and age who has a brand can thank Michael Jordan. It's not just athletes who he helped make money by creating brands, but like anybody in the entertainment world who was making money off of endorsement deals and promoting shit, that is thanks to Michael Jordan and the gamble that he and Nike took on each other. And, Jordan dominated. It's actually crazy that he only won 5 MVPs, because I kind of feel like Jordan probably could have won an MVP every single year that he played. I just kind of feel like voters tend not to want to do that. I don't want to say they collude together, but I just kind of feel like there are some years where they're like, I'm not going to vote for you because you won last year. Kind of how I feel about Jokic not getting the MVP last year. That's kind of why I feel like Jordan didn't win the MVP every year, because people are like, we can't give it to Jordan again, but whatever. So in his first season, that's the only MVP year where he did not win a championship. He averaged 35 points per game, 5.5 rebounds per game, and 5.9 assists per game. In his second MVP run in the 1990-91 season, he averaged 31.5 points per game, 6 rebounds per game, and 5.5 assists per game. Then his third MVP run in the 91-92 season, he averaged 30.1 points per game, 6.4 rebounds per game, and 6.1 assists per game. Then in his fourth MVP run in the 95-96 season, he averaged 37.7 points per game. The dude almost averaged 40 points per game after he came back from retirement. And then he averaged 6.6 rebounds per game and 4.3 assists per game. And then his fifth and final MVP year, the 97-98 year, he averaged 28.7 points per game, 5.8 rebounds per game, and 3.5 assists per game. Like I said, nobody dominated like Jordan. That's why you still hear about Jordan today. I know LeBron lovers, they can't stand it. And I know you can make arguments for LeBron being the greatest of all time. I'm actually not going to argue against it. That's fine if you think he's the greatest, but I'm sorry. If you were not around in the Jordan era, you don't know how much, like, that was all we heard about. That was all we talked about. That was all we knew. That's why when I say I'm shocked he did not win the MVP every single year he played, because that's how good he was. That's how dominating he was. Michael Jordan was the NBA in the 90s. And then finally, number one on my top five NBA MVPs, it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You know, if you've heard my list, my NBA GOATs list, he is my number one overall GOAT. I put him over everybody. He is a six-time champion, just like Michael Jordan. He is a six-time MVP, just like nobody else. Nobody has won six MVPs like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar won three of those MVPs when he played with the Milwaukee Bucks, and three of them when he played with the Los Angeles Lakers. His first one was in 1970-71 when he was with the Bucks, the 71-72 season with the Bucks, and the 73-74 season with the Bucks. So he won three straight there. Then when he would move on to the Lakers, he would win his first MVP and fourth overall MVP in the 75-76 season. And he'd win his fifth MVP in the 76-77 season. And then he would win his sixth and final MVP in the 79-80 season. So that's just another dude who absolutely dominated. I mean, Kareem was just meant to play basketball. If you just watch him play, it's the most beautiful and insane level of play you will see. He dominated. Absolute. Talk about a dude who probably could have been MVP every year as well. It's him too. He played in an era with a dude named Wilt Chamberlain. So he played against good-ass dudes. He played in Milwaukee for a period of time and even won a championship with them. Then, of course, he played with the Showtime Lakers. And then, of course, in six of these MVPs, two of them he won championships in the 1970-71 season with the Bucks, and then the 1979-1980 season with the Lakers. Those are 2 years when he won championships with his MVP years. But, I mean, really, nobody dominated the league like Kareem did when in his heyday, including when he was a college player, including when he was a high schooler. I mean, Kareem is basketball. So in his first MVP run, the 1970-71 season, he averaged 31.7 points per game, 16 rebounds per game, and 3.3 assists per game. His second MVP run, 71-72 season, he averaged 34.8 points per game, 16.6 rebounds per game, and 4.6 assists per game. His third MVP run in the 73-74 season, he averaged 27 points per game, 14.5 rebounds per game, and 4.8 assists per game. Then in the 75-76 season, his fourth MVP, he averaged 27.7 points per game, 16.9 rebounds per game, and 5 assists per game. In his fifth MVP run in the 76-77 season, he averaged 26.2 points per game, 13.3 rebounds per game, and 3.9 assists per game. And then in his sixth and final MVP season, he in the 79-80 season, he averaged 24.8 points per game, 10.8 rebounds per game, and 4.5 assists per game. So in all those MVP years, he averaged a double-double a game. And like I said, this guy just dominated. It's crazy to think how much he dominated. And if you don't know, the Milwaukee Bucks have pretty much been trash other than when Kareem played for them And when right now with Giannis playing for them. But I mean, the Bucks were never a place you wanted to go. He got drafted there and he gave it his all there until he could. And then they basically worked out a deal to send him to LA, and the rest is history there. But Kareem Abdul-Jabbar not only is the greatest multi-time NBA MVP, but to me, he is the greatest of all time. I mean, come on. A dude who they, in college, they got rid of the slam dunk because of him, because they were like, this guy dominates too much. We got to get rid of the slam dunk. So that's where the hook shot came from. And when rules are created to prevent you from scoring because you're that dominant, and then you have to create a move that they still can't stop and you're still that dominant, hello, how can you not be the GOAT? He's definitely the GOAT of the MVPs, and not just because he's won six, but because he really was one of the most dominating figures, especially of his era, and he played against some really damn good centers. I mean, Kareem played in an era when center was the center of attention on the team. Like, the center used to be the most dominating position on the court. Now it's mostly like the guard position or sometimes the forward position, because it's all about scoring and offense these days. But the center, I mean, as you could tell, I had Wilt Chamberlain on there. I mean, really, just look at actually these multi-time MVPs. Jokic, power forward slash center. Kareem, center. Bill Russell, center. Wilt Chamberlain, center. It's a dominating position, and it's not as dominating anymore. But Kareem played when it was the most dominating position. And like I said, he played against dudes like Wilt fucking Chamberlain, for Christ's sake. All right. So that's my top five for this week. All right. And let's get into the top five list this week. Since we are currently watching the NBA Conference Finals, I decided to do a list that involves that topic. We're going to do the top five greatest conference finals performances ever. And basically what that means is it's just a player, not a team, not even a series. This is a game in an NBA Conference Finals matchup where they just dominated. Now, one thing they had to do in this list is they had to win that game. They didn't have to win the entire series. They didn't even have to go on to win the NBA Finals. It's just, what kind of a game did they have in one of the seven or five in certain cases, because, you know, they used to only have five games in a series, but one game in the entire series where this player just dominated and took it to a whole other level. So far, we haven't really had anybody do that this season. I guess you could say Jaylen Brown, maybe, because he had that huge overtime shot, and yeah, he showed up huge in game two as well with the 40 points. And then Luka, he also had an amazing game. But like these five performances that I'm about to talk about, they were game changers. So let's go ahead and start it off with number five. This one actually I remember because it's only a couple years ago, by the way. But it was an amazing performance. And that is Jimmy Butler, the 2022 Eastern Conference Finals Game 6. He played for the Miami Heat and they were at the Boston Celtics. And in this series, since it's game six, you know, obviously Miami needed this one. They were down in the series 3-2. So they had to take this one. And this was in Boston. And it's hard to win in Boston. Well, guess what? Jimmy Butler gave zero fucks this night. He absolutely took over this game, dropped 47 points, 9 assists, 8 rebounds, and had 4 steals on the night. And just really, absolutely, he basically took down Boston all on his own. It was one of the most crazy sequences of events to ever happen. Basically, they won this game, took it to a game 7, and they went back to Miami for game 7, and they would ultimately end up taking down the Boston Celtics and ultimately going to the NBA Finals. And losing in the NBA Finals, I believe to the Warriors. Was it to the Warriors? I'm pretty sure it was the Warriors. I can't recall. It was a couple years ago, but I'm pretty sure it was the Warriors who they lost to. Regardless, it was one of the most amazing. Not only was just that Game 6 performance amazing from Jimmy Butler, but overall that Eastern that playoff run for Miami, Jimmy Butler was on some and was just insane. He was just on a tear during that playoff run. Then at number four on my top five greatest conference finals performances ever, Terry Porter in the 1992 Western Conference Finals Game 2. He played for the Portland Trail Blazers. They were playing the Utah Jazz. And this is one of the most efficient nights of shooting ever. And, you know, Terry Porter, he was an excellent player, but he just always got overshadowed by all the players who played at this time. You know, you got the Michael Jordans, you got the Hakeem Olajuwons, you got the Patrick Ewings, you got all these dudes who you usually talk about, but Terry Porter Jr. shined above the rest in this Western Conference Game 2. He went 12 for 14, and four of those were three-pointers. He went 13 for 14 at the free throw line. He ended up with a total of 41 points, 7 assists, 6 rebounds, and this is still, to this day, the fewest shot attempts ever for a player to reach 40 points. So this still stands. This happened in 1992, and that says a lot. That's why I put it in here. Even above Jimmy Butler, and they did get this. They did win this game, but they did not win the series. Then at number three on my top five greatest conference finals performances ever, Dirk Nowitzki in the 2011 Western Conference Finals Game 1, Dallas Mavericks versus Oklahoma City Thunder. He did play with the Dallas Mavericks in this one, of course, because who else did Dirk play for? But in this dominating performance, he dropped 48 points. He went 12 for 15 from the field, 24 for 24 at the free throw line. And not only did they win the Western Conference Finals against a really good ass, this was the Oklahoma City Thunder team that had Kevin Durant, James Harden, Russell Westbrook, all in like the prime of their careers. This Oklahoma City Thunder team just dominated, but Dirk Nowitzki was like, nah, I'm going to dominate. And even in this game, Kevin Durant dropped 40 points as well, but Dirk Nowitzki was like, no, dude, I'm Dirk. And this was the season actually where the Dallas Mavericks would go on to win the NBA Finals as well. But Dirk Nowitzki, he actually has a couple conference finals, legendary conference finals performance. But I feel like this one was the better of the two because, I mean, the efficiency. The other one, it was against the Phoenix Suns, I think a couple years before. And he had an extremely efficient night and he dropped 50 points. This one, though, it was so, Dirk was just on, and I remember this game. It was like he could not miss, and then he just kept getting to the free throw line, and you're like, Jesus Christ, this guy's going to outscore everybody. He did, and the Dallas Mavericks would go on to win this game, win this series, and win the title. Then number two on my top five greatest conference finals performances ever, Michael Jordan, the 1989 Eastern Conference Finals Game 3, when he was with the Chicago Bulls versus the Detroit Pistons. And this Pistons team dominated Michael Jordan. They dominated the league, especially defensively. And but what stood out about this game in particular is it's probably where we're introduced to the dominance that would become Michael Jordan. Because obviously the Bulls would not go on to win the finals that year. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't even win this series, but they did win game three. They trailed by 14 points at one point in this game. And basically Michael Jordan single-handedly brought them back 14 points down and they would ultimately win the game 99-97. Jordan's stat line would end up being 46 points, 7 rebounds, 5 assists, 5 steals, and he went 10 for 17 in the fourth quarter in a 3-minute stretch, including the game winner. So this was like just the introduction. Not only was it just an amazing, dominating performance from one player just single-handedly turning this game around and making it his own, but it was basically the turning point of the league where, yes, Michael Jordan would lose that series, but that would be the last time we would see that shit. Then the Bulls would take over and basically dominate the rest of the 90s. And basically Michael Jordan would go on to dominate the league for the next 6, 7, 8 years. But this right here was the welcome to the NBA experience of Michael Jordan for everybody, where he would just take over and he was just had that killer instinct where he'd just be like, no, I'm Michael Jordan. I'm going to win this shit. And that's exactly what he did in this game 3 performance. And even though the Bulls did lose this series, like I said. Sometimes you need that to become the best. And I feel like a game like that was what really just set Jordan apart and really just gave him a boost of confidence to let him know that, yeah, I am really as good as I think I am. Now it's time to show the rest of the world and make them believers. And he did. Now, there is only one performance above that, and it was really difficult to put anybody above Michael Jordan in that one, especially because he single-handedly won that game. Single-handedly. But there is one performance in the conference finals that I feel like is just the greatest ever. And that is number one on my top five greatest conference finals performances ever. Charles Barkley in the 1993 Western Conference Finals Game 5 when he was with the Phoenix Suns versus the Seattle Supersonics. Yes, that's how long ago this was, when the Seattle Supersonics were a team and they were not the Oklahoma City Thunder. Charles Barkley had one of the most single-handed dominating performances ever. His stat line, 43 points, 15 rebounds, and 10 assists. Yes, that is a triple-double, y'all. And he did that all in 47 minutes and did not sit for more than 1 minute in this game. He played the entire fucking game. He went 16 for 22 from the field and 11 for 11 at the free throw line. This was one of the most dominating individual performances you have ever seen in playoff history, let alone conference finals history. Unfortunately for Charles, his Phoenix Suns team would go on to the NBA Finals and lose to Michael Jordan in the NBA Finals. But Charles Barkley, this, if there is one game you can point to in his career where it was just flawless, it was stellar, it was amazing, it would be this 1993 Western Conference Finals Game 5. He was better than every motherfucker on the court. He could not be stopped. As a matter of fact, if you put him 5-on-1 on the court, him by himself versus the 5 Seattle Supersonics starters, he still would have been as amazing as he was that night. That is how on Charles Barkley was in the 1993 Western Conference Finals, Game 5. So that is my top 5 list for the week.